Welcome home.
Thank you. I actually never left, but it's nice to be back. Nice to see everyone. And to return to the activities that I'm used to doing most of the time. Because I was not doing these much of this while I was in the United States. I was doing other things. And I'm reminded when Seu says, welcome back, and I say, I never went anywhere. I think of the koan, there's all several of these koans where the teacher, the monk arrives in the monastery and the teacher says, where have you been? And the monk says, whatever, wherever he's been, I was at such and such a place, on this mountain with this teacher or whatever it is. And the teacher, you know, invariably takes up his stick and hits him or, you know, says, you rice bag, something like that. And so when I give that response, I hear myself in that kind of mindset. But, you know, I do mean it in the sense that for my mind, you know, my mind has different scales that measures things. So it measures the distance, the time zones, the speed of the airplane, the temperature, the size of the buildings, all kinds of age, nationality, measures all these things, these scales in my mind. But things as they are don't have any scales. So, you know, if I think about how many thousands of miles, kilometers I covered, the speed of the airplane, traveling at 30,000 feet, crossing 7 time zones, continents, countries, ocean. If I think of all of those things, then it's one experience. If I don't take any of that into consideration, then I'm always just right here. Well, maybe when I say not take into consideration, not make that my primary experience. So of course I realized that I was on a different continent. It was 30 degrees. It's not 30 degrees here in Paris. The people are American for the most part. But even that, you know, it's a very diverse population. So the city my mother lives in 20 years ago didn't look like it does now. There are lots of Hispanic, Latino people now. There weren't 20 years ago. So even those kinds of things change. And when I'm sitting there on the airplane, I'm not thinking I'm 30,000 feet up in the air and I'm traveling at 300, I don't know how many miles per hour, crossing each step of the ocean, whatever. I'm just sitting there on the airplane. And when I get off the airplane, I'm just sitting here. I'm always just sitting here. And yet, the circumstances are different. The manifestations of Mu are different. The temperature is different if we start measuring things. And yet, it's all this, just as it is. So it's from that where I say I didn't go anywhere. I was always here. And my body, the reason that we think the way we do with our scales is because our body is part of that. So my body is trying to catch up with the time difference. So I've been back for 24 hours in this time zone, and I'm feeling it. I'm tired, jet lag. Yet, whether I was there or here, when we speak in these terms, I'm just here. So I'm just here with the jet lag. I just am jet lag. That's all. It's not. I don't need it to be any other way. I might like it to be some other way. I might want to not feel this jet lag, but it's just what it is. It's neither good nor bad. It's just my body, which is part of the world of scales. My body grows old. My body becomes sick. My body at some point will die. My body was small and then it grew. My body changes. It's part of the world of scales. Yet my experience of it is just this. It's just, I'm always here. So, travel is very interesting for that, you know? To experience deeply the differences, whether it's language, food, culture, appearance, architecture, values, even the taste of food. You know, I spent 2 weeks eating, you know, mostly what I eat all the time, a lot of fruit and vegetables. I bought organic fruit and vegetables when I was there. And I came home today and I ate a banana and it tasted like a banana. Whereas the bananas I had been eating, they just didn't taste like bananas, you know, or they did, but. And my daughter said the same thing to me this summer when she was visiting. She lives in the US. And she said, oh, it's so nice to have a peach that tastes like a peach. And I didn't really know what she was talking about. But now having experienced it, I know I don't have any explanation for that. I don't know why it's like that. But it's different. So food is different. The air is different. The temperature is different. People are different. And yet, it's all mu, as we say in our Zen jargon. It's all just this. So, I was actually going to, thought of maybe I had a dream last night in which one of my Dharma sisters, who some of you know, Miriam, actually I think everyone here knows Miriam, maybe. So there was Miriam and there was me and a couple other people. And I think we were in a retreat or something. And in fact, I know we were, but it didn't seem like a retreat. And Miriam, and I don't know who else, but Miriam was doing something she really enjoyed doing. I don't know what it was, but she enjoyed it. But it was something that, you know, it was like if you're during the work period, you have a job that you really like. You're participating in the work period, but you really like this thing. Whatever it is, pulling weeds or something. And so then this other woman came up who was apparently someone in authority who, like maybe the Samu leader or something like that, and came up and you know, kind of yelled at Miriam and said, what are you doing here? This isn't what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be back at the house or something like that. Taking care of practice. That was the phrase, taking care of practice. Something like that. And so it was like she was shaming Miriam and telling her she should be doing something else. And so Miriam was kind of surprised. And I was surprised too. And so I said to the other woman, "What do you mean she's supposed to be taking care of practice? She's always taking care of practice. This is taking care of practice," or something like that. And Miriam was very grateful in the dream, and the other woman was kind of disgusted. Like I had said that. And so when I woke up, I was thinking about this, and I think part of it was, it reminded me of a situation that I had experienced in the US when I was at a big, you know, like kind of like Monoprix type store. But there was a Starbucks in the store. And my sister had asked me to bring her some Starbucks coffee. So I'm there. And there were these two women behind the counter, and one was training the other one to do the job. And while she was doing it, some other woman who worked at the store but was not behind the counter at Starbucks came up and started talking a bit to the woman who was training, like this woman in the dream had been talking to Miriam, and said to her, "So did you look at your schedule for the week?" She was obviously some kind of boss. And the woman who was training said, she said, "Did you look at your schedule for next week, for the rest of the week?" And she said, "No, I haven't yet." And she said, "Well, you didn't even look at it today because you're not supposed to be here today. You're supposed to be doing something else, some other task." And the woman was kind of surprised, or the two women were kind of surprised. And so the woman said, "Go look at your schedule." And she said, "Okay, I will. I'm going to finish this." And she said, "No, go look at it now." And so the woman had to leave and go look at it. And I'm standing there waiting for my coffee, and the other woman's making it. And the woman, the boss lady, looked really happy that she had taken this woman away from this job that seemed to be a really nice job, working the counter at Starbucks, compared to, I don't know, stocking the shelves with cans or something. I don't know what the other jobs would be. And this other woman seemed so happy to be taking her away from that. And then they went off. And I couldn't help but notice that the two women behind the counter at Starbucks were Black women, and the boss lady was a white woman. And much older, probably 15 or 20 years older than the other two. And her whole attitude was kind of like frustration and wanting to take away someone else's pleasure and relishing her position of power, maybe something like that. And I don't know in the dream if it was a similar kind of situation. And yet at the same time, it was related directly to our practice. I could say that the experience with the Starbucks people and all of that was part of our practice too, was the woman was working. She was doing what she thought she was supposed to be doing. The other woman came over to tell her she wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing. But, and I don't know what the schedule said, it didn't concern me, but it was the whole interaction that was very telling to me. So, taking care of practice. We're always taking care of practice, is what I said to that lady in the dream. What does it mean to take care of, and what does it mean to practice? And how do we do that? how do we not become you know, when we sit, you know, sometimes people say I get caught up in my thoughts. And when we don't sit too, you know, when we're out in the world doing our stuff, we get caught up too with our ideas and our attachments and our objections and all that. And I like this thing that Suzuki Roshi said of, he told his students that when you're sitting, you leave your front door and your back door open. And you let the thoughts come and go. And he said, just don't serve them tea. So you let the thoughts come and go. Let them come in the front door, go out the back door, come in the back door, go out the front door. But don't invite them to sit down for tea. Because that's when we start getting in trouble. That's when we become fixed. That's when we miss what's really happening because we're getting involved with our thoughts. So maybe we can say we're taking care of practice when we just let things be. It doesn't mean we don't act, but we come to any situation with this mind of the front and the back door open and not knowing what will arise, what will enter, and then not serving tea to all this stuff. Sometimes it's appropriate to serve tea when it's appropriate to serve tea. So when I'm you know, like I always use the example, and I've just traveled, so this is a very common example, but I'm not attached to being who I am, to some age, person, name, country. I'm not attached. I try not to become attached to that identity. And yet, when I come to the passport control, I have to be very attached to that identity. I have to really be that person. You know, I have to give them my passport. And when they ask me questions about it, I have to answer. And when they ask me to see my vaccination certificate, I have to show it. When they say, where are you going? Where do you live? I can't say, well, I'm not going anywhere. I don't live anywhere. I'm always here. This is my home. And they wouldn't let me through the passport control. And I realized how attached I am. For example, I have two passports. I have a French one and an American one. And just before my trip, like 2 days before my trip, when I was getting my documents ready, I realized my French passport was expired. Fortunately, I had realized my American passport was expired in the spring, and so I renewed it. So I had a passport to travel with, but otherwise I would not have had a passport. And I realized how attached I was to my French passport. I was thinking, oh, I don't want to fly back into Paris and have to show my American passport. When I come to France, I show my French one. When I go to the US, I show my American one. You're not supposed to do that, but I do. And I thought, oh boy, now I come back to Paris and I have to show my friend my American passport. It's absurd, right? But it's this strong identity we can have. So I showed my American passport. It didn't matter one bit, you know. Actually, there were no French people coming. I don't think there were any French people on any of my airplanes because it's only been recently that they could go to the US. So, you know, it's... So, can we be free enough to open our doors, let the thoughts come and go? don't serve them tea. So I let the thought in. I'm attached to my French passport, but I don't serve it tea. I say, au revoir. Bye-bye. And it goes on. The not wanting to show my American passport thought comes in. I don't serve it tea. I just let it go. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do what needs to be done. So. So what does that mean for the rest of our lives? Someone was telling me that, talking about mu, and saying, but yeah, well, what do I do with it then? What do I do with it? Passing mu, like, yeah, but what do I do with it? I said, well, what do you mean do with it? What do you have to do with it? Be it. Be it, you know? So, anyone else like to say anything? What's been going on for you in the past 2 weeks since we last spoke, saw each other here, or today, or whatever, or something came up from what I said? Right.
If home is everywhere, or if home is here, there's no home to live.
That's right. And that's a huge relief, actually. You know, Suzuki also said, you know, we shouldn't forget that we're the center of the universe and that we are sitting in the center of the universe. So you could say home, you know, we are our home and we're always sitting in the middle of our home. That's true. And then can we truly be at home everywhere, wherever we are? It's a challenge sometimes. You know? This doesn't mean that it isn't necessary to have a place that we call home. That's very important. It's part of our human condition. Well, our animals too, they all have their homes, their nests. Debbie?
I was just looking at everybody and thinking how many of us have this either dual or more nationality business going on. And I am absolutely not a patriot of either country. And yet, I know what you mean. I don't think I've ever come back into France with an American passport. And I don't want to go into the United States with a French passport. I don't know if it's just obsessionalism or keeping things straight. But I was just watching an old Ram Dass conference with a whole bunch of, what's her name, Sharon. I like her very much. I can't remember her name. Sharon something Berg?
Salzburg.
What is it?
Salzburg?
Yes, Salzburg. and Ram Dass and other people. And one of the men, I don't know which one, this who this guy was say an American, was saying that he had been in India learning to chant for many years, but when he started writing about it in his own native tongue, it got very much more complicated. As long as he was chanting in Pali or whatever they chant in, it bypassed his mental business. But once he started writing about his emotions about meditation and chanting in English, because I know the languages make things very confusing too, or confusing. Yeah, complicated. All kinds of very strong emotions about certain vocabulary. Also, I like words, and I have all kind of tangled up personal relationship with certain words, certain letters. I'm heavy into language. And I think that others of you are too. This being attached, detached from it. Yeah, no, I was just aware when you were talking how that passport thing can be quite a revelation in any case.
Yeah. Thanks. Seu.
Yeah. I don't know so good what I want to say with it, with this, but I feel it's not easy to be, it's not always easy to be home. Sometimes we are not quiet and we are not home. We feel not home. And we try again and again, and we are always moving. This is more personally, and I related that with one thing that happened in here in Lisbon about a man who I don't know if you know the name from Aristides Sousa Mendes. It was a man who was in Lisbon. We have perhaps all the countries have a pantheon, you know, where you put the real important people from this land. And Aristides Sousa Mendes, it was a consul in Brussels in the 2nd Weltkrieg, in the Deuxième Guerre.
Second World War.
He was a consul, a Portuguese consul in Brussels. And he desobedecer. He goes against a law from Salazar, the dictator in Portugal, in this time, and he give in 3 days 10,000 passports to people to change and to run away from were. And this week, because a black woman who sits in our parliament, the first black woman who sits in our parliament, she asked to make homage mm-hmm. to this attitude from this man. He was a man, a consul, with a family with 14
children.
14 enfants, des enfants. Il avait 14 enfants. He go against this law and he risked to lose the career, job, money, everything. And he lose everything. He die in misery. But in these 3 days, he make an organization with other people who work with him to make passports and passports and passports. He go to the front, to the border, to give passports to the people. And for me, he said that he don't know why, but he need to do that. It's when he need to choose between the order from a man or from God, he prefer to follow the order from God. It was in him. It was a Christian. And I related with this to be home. He was home. For me, he was at this moment, at this attitude, this I think for him, it was equal to have a home or not. This attitude, it was home for him. To do the right thing, to do the appropriate when we feel quiet, we feel we are home. Sorry, I don't know if I...
No. Thank you. And in order to listen to that order from God, like you say, I don't know if he said that exactly, but he had to, or one would have to, let go of ideas and positions in order to be open to knowing that that was what needed to be done. Not hanging on to some idea that he had to follow the dictator or that he might lose everything, but realizing that that was what needed to be done. And we all have that same opportunity every moment, not, of course, not to save 10,000 lives, but who knows? You know, we don't know. We make the important thing is to, in this moment, whatever it is, this moment, you can make all the difference. And each moment does make all the difference. Lisa?
Hi. Makes me think the story that Sue tells. And being well, how difficult it is to sometimes take a stand, I witnessed something last weekend. I was biking up near Place des Fêtes, close to where I live, and I saw those. I saw a scene where I saw a guy running and a cop running after the guy, and a cop on a motorcycle. It seemed like a movie. Guy on a motorcycle, a cop racing after the guy running, and the other cop running after the first guy. Anyway, and at some point they jumped on him and stopped him, and the guy was on the ground. And he was lying down on the floor. It almost made me think of, what we see in the US, and they were sitting on the guy who couldn't do anything. At some point, they set him down on the floor, and the guy who was on the motorcycle left, and they called for reinforcement. And while the other cops were arriving, before they arrived, the one that had run after the bad guy, let's call him, who was sitting on the floor on the ground with a foot without a shoe, he had lost one shoe. And I was like completely, I was stuck. I couldn't not look. And the guy, the cop was whispering stuff to him and sort of like menacing him. Like I heard him say something, and after a while he kept doing it to the guy and maltreating him and being abusive. And I was just, so anyway, the other cops arrive and I was there standing, and I didn't think of taking my phone out and filming the situation, but one of the guy comes to me, and I started saying, why are you treating this guy this way? He's not going to run away. and the cop came and said, you don't know what he's done. I said, well, I don't care what he's done. It doesn't matter. You're not supposed to treat him that way, whatever he's done. And well, I didn't say it in all these words, but that's what it meant. And the cop said, well, if you continue standing there, move away. Otherwise, we'll take you to the police station. And I was so like shocked. I left. So what you're saying was like, wow, all those people who resist and who fight back, and as just one thing from this, and nothing would have happened to me, obviously. I mean, they would have taken me to the police station, and then what? I'm white, I have my passport, I have my papers, and nothing could happen to me, I suppose. But still. And I was shocked because, this is France. This is not supposed to happen. And the way they were treating this man on the floor, who had apparently knocked down an old lady and was running off with her purse or something, was not supposed to be treated that way, even if he'd done it. So it was very, standing up for your principle and fighting for them. It's tough. and I just can't imagine not, what I would do in a situation like, during the Second World War, or in a country where you know, rights were abused and people were abused. And so, yeah, I don't know. And it was a shock. I thought I was more brave. well, I did say something, but I wasn't that brave at the end of the day. So it was a lesson. I don't know. It's just that's what Seo said made me think of that.
He was in a power position. He was.
Yes, understood.
Was also a reason to be able to do this, all these things.
Well, just for the French people, the funny thing is the guy at some point told me, well, if you're not happy, go and vote for Mélenchon. I mean, how can a cop say something like that? It's like, came out of nowhere. It's like, anyway, voilà, that's my story. Sad story.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I don't, we have these extreme cases and the same thing applies, like I said, every moment. So we can maybe look at, well, then in every moment, do I do the same thing, you know? Do I see the moment clearly and yet act in a different way? There was no way you should have acted in that moment. It's understandable, all of your behavior. I've been in similar situations here in Montreuil. Yeah. And haven't left. And they didn't do anything to me. But, you know. I didn't film, but have, you know, stood there and had them scream at me to go away and just stood there. And I said, I have every right to stand here. I'm not interfering with anything. Anyway, there's no right or wrong, and it's an interesting, but it's interesting to look at, exactly like you say, you know. Freddie?
Every time we go near someone who begs money, to me it's always, it's like it's not something for every day. There's always a question, do I leave something? If I'm not leaving something, am I stingy? Do I do anything? It's always, I think we can always ask ourselves this question. There's always a difficult situation in front of us, I think. That's the way I see things, always. And that's it.
Yeah, you know, it's the best thing we can do is to be aware of our own internal tendencies and the greater tendencies of the society at large. and how we might how we've internalized a lot of the patterns and the values and the habits of the world around us. I saw this movie Nomadland on the airplane, and about these people who choose to live on the margins in the United States, living in vans and mobile homes rather than, sometimes they don't have a choice, but sometimes they do, rather than participate in the, you know, the consumer economy and buying and having and all of this. And some of them really look into their tendencies towards greed and grasping, and how that's just an internal, they've just internalized that behavior, the values of the culture at large. And we can do that, we don't have to go leave our homes and quit our jobs and go live in a van in the desert to do that. We can look at that at every moment. Like, you know, Freddie says, is when someone asks for money and how generous and am I not generous? And Lisa's saying, you know, I didn't stand up for my principles or whatever. We can look at it every moment. So every moment, am I grasping at something? Am I clinging to something? Am I using a harsh word with someone? Every moment we have this possibility in all the different aspects of our life to look at it. Am I abusing my position, or am I, you know, the Portuguese consul in Brussels could have abused his position and, you know, really delved into the records and found all the Jews and turned them over to the Nazis, you know, or something. But he decided to use to not abuse his power, but to use it. We could say he was abusing it, but to use it to further life rather than to, and wholeness rather than create division and disharmony and harm. And we all have those choices we can make every moment. And we are conditioned by our circumstances. You know, whatever, wherever we live, our family, our cultures. And so how do we free ourselves from them? We open the front door, we open the back door, and we let it come and go.
It's a beautiful image.
Isn't it though? It's really a beautiful image. It's not mine, it's from Suzuki, but it's a really nice image, yeah. And it's a very different image than saying, close the doors and the windows. Don't let anything in. Don't let anything out. Don't let anything in. Very different image, you know. Joao?
There is something I don't get, because in the very beginning, when I knew, when I learned about Buddhism and meditation, there is this thing that we do before entering the Zendo, this thing with taking the shoes off and leaving them outside. And I had this idea in the beginning, someone explained it to me or whatever. It's about leaving your worries outside. And I have never thought about this anymore. But lately, this came back to me, and these are always symbolic stuff. So, and I was kind of wondering, it can't be. I was thinking like, no, it can't be that. It doesn't make. Doesn't make any sense. I don't know, because in retreats we also talk about, when we go to a retreat, it's a chance of living in a way like outside, not in our usual patterns of behaving or something. So I was just wondering what is this with this leaving your shoes outside.
Well, I've never heard the description that you gave. I always thought it was just really practical, you know, so that we keep the space clean, and it's also tradition in Japanese homes to take off your shoes when you go in. And I never heard that, what you said. So it wasn't me who told you that when you first came to.
No.
So I don't know what that is. Seems very sensible to me to take off. So we all agree to take off our shoes so we can walk safely barefoot. And, you know, also all of these rules about the Zendo help us to, they give us a very specific framework, which helps us to decondition from our usual stuff. I use decondition, but helps us to not be caught up in our usual way of sitting, walking, sitting down, standing up. We don't talk. We don't really look at the other people. You know, all this stuff. It's a very specific framework made to help us. I always thought taking off the shoes was part of that, and very culturally influenced by Japan, where that's what you do in every house and every building, or buildings. I don't know, but homes, yes. But when we, you know, we come to retreat, it's not that we, it's just we're changed, the circumstances are different. The conditions are different. And so that gives us an opportunity to not be involved with our usual stuff of paying bills and talking to our partners and feeding the children and getting the car fixed, or not having a car and having to do such and such, whatever, you know. Different circumstances. Travel does the same thing. It takes you out of your usual environment, puts you in a new one, and that changes the way that you experience the world because it's different.
Different banana.
Yeah, absolutely. We are out of time. Using the scale, our mental scale of time and minutes, so we're out of time. Thank you. Thank you also for those of you who attended in the past 2 weeks. I felt your presence even if I wasn't here. And thank you to Joa for stepping in and helping you to sit here together. We have a retreat coming up, not this weekend, but the following weekend. I just remind you. If you didn't know that, then several possibilities. You didn't receive the email with the dates, or you didn't read the email, or you didn't see that date when you did read the email. So if you didn't read the email, you're all on the mailing list. You should check your spam or junk or something. Because I think a lot of people aren't getting emails. So. Okay, let's say the vows and finish for tonight.